Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcasts. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm one of the RCGP e-learning fellows. And today I'm talking to Dr. Kati Bakai, who is a GP in Northeast London. And today we're chatting about eczema.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you today. And Kati, you've been one of our e-learning writers, as I understand.
Yes, I've been authoring with the RCGP, I think, for over 5-6 years, as well as working for over 10 years in East London in Tower Hamlets.
Today we're talking about eczema, and I should declare at the beginning that I'm a GP with eczema. I got my eczema in my 20s, so this is kind of an interest area for me. Have you got interest in eczema and skin issues?
So similarly, I have children with eczema, and so have done quite a bit of looking into the topic and area and sort of lived experience of this as well.
So very much today we're talking about how to initially assess eczema, manage it in primary care. And it's one of these kind of very common conditions that we see a lot of in primary care. And I think it's really key we get the basics right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Really common. So probably around 1 in 5 children have eczema and 1 in 10 adults in the UK, actually. So almost every GP will be managing it regularly. And although most children do improve by their teenage years, you still have people with persistent and adult onset, like you said, eczema as well.
And by eczema, what do we mean?
People call it eczema or atopic dermatitis, but generally when we're using these terms, we're talking about a chronic and relapsing inflammatory skin condition, usually characterized with dryness, itchiness, inflamed skin. And we often see it alongside patients with asthma and allergic rhinitis as well.
Is that kind of A to B triad that we talk about?
Exactly.
Obviously, we mentioned a little bit about risk factors, sort of family history as well, or any other risk factors?
Yeah, there's actually a really strong genetic component. 75% of patients who have eczema tend to have a family history, and it's to do actually with genes that affect the skin barrier. So a family history of atopy tends to be a strong risk factor, but also environmental risk factors as well, what you're in contact with. But also there's a strong link with deprivation, particularly where I work in Northeast London. We see a huge amount of eczema, which is exacerbated by things like overcrowded housing, pollution, and often access to the right emollients as well.
And how might it typically present? Obviously, we talk about sort of dry skin, itching as sort of key clinical features. Parents might notice some changes on the baby's skin.
Yes, exactly those things. So most of us now will be seeing these sorts of presentations through online consultations, I think, across the UK. As patients are doing more of these, they're attaching photos of their children themselves. And we see this distribution of sort of dry, itchy, red, inflamed skin. Often the itching is the bit that's really bothering people. And the distribution of where we see this does vary depending on age. And very typically, from a textbook perspective, you see the younger infants with eczema on their cheeks or scalp or trunk and the extensor surfaces, whereas children and adults, you see these skin changes in the flexural areas like the elbows, knees and neck. And then depending on the stage at which they contact us, you'll find excoriations, you may even find lichenification and changes in the skin. And not to forget that we may see it presented differently in different coloured skin as well. So in darker skin, you may not get the typical redness, but you may see it as a grayish purple color or slightly darker brown rather than a red, making the inflammation harder to spot. So it's definitely something we need to check ourselves on. And then again, in terms of presentations, you might see hypo or hyperpigmentation, which is sometimes quite distressing for patients. And then in some worst case scenarios, we see it presented with skin breaks. So you see cracking and fissures in the skin. If we're then seeing overlying infection on that, we may even see weeping or crusting or vesicles. So that's quite serious.
So obviously you mentioned there's quite a lot of different presentations of eczema, can present with infection sometimes. And often when I see children with it, the parents often worry they've done something wrong or they've given the child an infection. So I think there's a lot of potential misinformation around eczema probably.
Absolutely. I think there is a lot around people worrying, particularly in my cohort of patients, about allergies to food. And often patients come in or parents come in asking for allergy testing around this. So there's some small cohort of patients where it may coexist with things like cow's milk, protein allergy. But generally speaking, unless there's a really clear, immediate sort of food-related symptom, large proportion of these patients, there isn't a connection with that. And there's often quite a lot of misinformation about what sort of things to use on the skin to make it better. and how often to wash and shower them as well. So as part of our consultations, it's really important to provide clear information in a way that patients can understand and implement as well.
You mentioned about food allergy, and I think that would be the sort of very clear history about having milk or other products and then flaring up of the skin quite soon afterwards in terms of cow's milk protein allergy or other allergies.
Yes, absolutely. And then distribution wise, it's something to think about as well. So if it's very localized eczema in the flexures, for example, I'd be talking to parents or to adults to say, look, if it was an allergy to something like food, you would be seeing systemic symptoms. It wouldn't just be localized in these sorts of areas. And so it's helpful to talk through your reasoning behind why you may be diverting away from allergy testing. But then similarly, if you've got someone with very severe eczema, there is some bowel symptoms related to it, it's not responding to the kind of treatments you'd expect it to be responding to, then it is worth thinking about allergy testing as well.
As I say, most practices now doing online consultation, we might have a bit of information. Might be that we could look in the notes and see they've already got a diagnosis of eczema, and we're pretty certain maybe the consult says eczema flare-up. That would be quite simple to manage. But maybe if we go through, if it's a first consultation and we think this is likely eczema, what next process? It might be that we trial a treatment and bring them back for an assessment.
Yeah, so I think we need to make sure we differentiate between dry skin and eczema. And as far as possible, we've got so much workload on that dry skin is not a medical condition. We need to give people the tools to be able to manage it themselves with over-the-counter medication. Where we're seeing patients with a clear diagnosis of dermatitis and eczema, emollients are the absolute kind of cornerstone of management. And we need to be talking to parents and children themselves about restoring this healthy barrier to reduce frequency of flare-ups. So we start off with a discussion around emollients. We also make sure that parents and children understand potential triggers that might be causing it. And in younger people, we talk about fragrance products and soaps and avoiding those sorts of things. And this also is relevant to adults as well. So as a starting point, we're trying to identify and avoid triggers, provide information around emollients and trying to restore a healthy skin barrier to avoid flare-ups, and then thinking about bathing and soap substitutes as well.
That's really useful. Thank you. And I think there's some really good research over the past couple of years about emollients. So I'm thinking of a trial which compared different emollient types and found actually that they were all very similar in use. That's comparing lotions and creams and ointments. So those of you who may have not tried these out, the lotions and creams are more water-based and ointments are more oil-based, more sort of oily, sticky. And I think it's more about matching the right emollient to the child or the adult and a bit of trial and error, seeing what works best for you. But the most important thing is using it regularly and plenty of it.
Yes, exactly. So the best emollient for the person is the one that they're happy using as much as possible. And often you may give them a combination of creams and ointments. So for some patients, I would provide ointments at night because they don't necessarily want to walk around looking or feeling greasier in the daytime. And then providing different sizes as well, so they can keep the big tubs at home and maybe the smaller tubes, or they can decant into smaller tubes so they can carry them around in their work bag or school bag as they're going around.
That's really useful. A lot of the emollients do come as either 50 or 100 gram sizes. We have the typical 500 gram for most of them. I kind of use the ointment sometimes at night because it's a bit stickier, maybe less in the day, maybe a cream as a soap substitute. And there is another research that has been shown is there's no evidence for bath oils.
Exactly. And actually some risks around it with slippage and falls in the bathtubs and showers as well. So using soap substitutes, we're asking patients to essentially cream themselves before they shower and then shower it off or wash it off. And then again, another layer of emollient and patting dry as well. So again, putting that skin barrier back on.
So obviously we get the basic right with the emollient, and I think sometimes that can be practical. Sometimes the patients are not sure, I bring them in and say, how are you using your emollient? And often you find that they're using a very tiny amount. So I think sometimes having a face-to-face consultation is helpful, particularly with creams. You probably find that as well in your own practice.
We did some really interesting things actually in our practice. So when we have trainees, we've tried to just get a whole load of testers, which you can get from many of the cream companies actually, just to keep in the practice so that us as practitioners know what it feels like. And sometimes we can sort of show patients as well. We've also had a really good health day where we invited a whole load of children in with their parents to bathe their dinosaur toys in different types of emollients. So children and parents got to know how much to use, what to use. And actually, we had children showing really strong preferences for which one their dinosaur liked better as well. So it was a really good training event for staff and for the community as well.
Coming on to eczema flare treatments, so there we've got the topical steroids and steroid ladder, and we can cover that a little bit, and about how to use steroids and maybe protopics as well.
So next step, as you said, steroids for flares. I mean, the aim of the flares is to get them under control as quickly as possible, and really choosing the right potency of steroids is dependent on how much it's bothering the patient and how severe they feel it is. And I have some proxies, and this isn't sort of through guidelines really, but if it's affecting kids schooling, if it's affecting kids or adults in their sleep, I will probably err on the side of prescribing something a bit stronger so that we can get that under control as soon as possible. And obviously we start with the weaker steroids like hydrocortisone for younger children, for faces as well, and a moderate to potent ones for limbs and trunks. And then we talk about using fingertip units in terms of how much steroid to use. So from the tip of your index finger to the first line, that's one fingertip unit. And as a rough guidance, that amount of steroid should cover an area that's equivalent to the palm and sort of the back of your hand of an adult. So that gives a rough idea of how much steroid you might need.
A lot of parents, or maybe adults as well, get a little bit frightened about steroids. So I think it's all about safe use and minimizing risk.
Yes, exactly. I think parents do worry about skin thinning. They do worry about the systemic impact of steroids as well. And we know that actually there isn't a huge systemic impact when we're using steroids in this way. But certainly with repeated use, we are warning people about skin thinning. And if that's something that is of concern, if people with very frequent flare-ups, then we do need to consider other lines of treatments like protopics as well.
I always give the analogy with eczema when it flares, it's a bit like a fire coming on and you have to try and use the right extinguisher to put the fire out. And sometimes you need a stronger extinguisher and not to be afraid of that. So I think it's particularly for trainees who may be listening to this, it's getting used to that steroid ladder, matching the steroid to the intensity of the flare up. And don't be afraid of potent steroids, but in a safe way, in a step down approach. So sometimes people who have a flare sort of daily use, then step down to other day and then twice a week. And sometimes some patients who get recurrent flares may need a steroid once or twice a week, matched to their skin, and that's okay as long as that's done in a safe way. That's kind of more of a sort of safe maintenance to avoid flare-ups.
Yes, exactly. And do you often have patients asking you about what to use first, the emollients or the steroids? Have you had that conversation with them?
I have. And I think, I mean, my own preference, this is me as a patient, I prefer to use the emollient first, wait a little bit and then put the steroid on. But as I understand from evidence, there's no right or wrong answer. It depends on the individual, really.
Exactly. I think there's some literature that says give it an hour between, but it doesn't matter which one you use first. So that's what I say to patients. And I think particularly when we're talking to trainees about this, eczema is a really great condition to sort of demonstrate shared decision making. So we can be saying to patients, look, I can see you've got bad eczema on your elbows. We can go for a short, sharp burst of a stronger steroid if it's really bothering you, or we could use a slightly milder steroid, but you might need to use it a bit longer. And it's a really great way of having the patient's input into their own care and really empower them so that they know what they need or what they want next time they have a flare-up.
Obviously, then maybe next step, protopic. So sometimes tacrolimus is a common one that we use as a protopic. Can use that in children and adults, particularly some good evidence for eyelid eczema and face eczema to avoid having to use steroids, but obviously with sun protection, or people who may be having recurrent flare-ups and we're using more potent steroids, it's quite a good option to consider trying out a protopic, though some patients can have a little bit of stinging or other side effects with it.
Yes, correct. And also that it's licensed for children over the age of 2. So we're usually using that for slightly older children and adults as well. And usually, again, applied twice a day to dry skin. So not one that's sticky with emollient, or leaving it at least an hour as well.
And some people find that as a good alternative as an eczema control cream.
Particularly where I think people are not tolerating or not responding to steroids, or that you're seeing beginnings of thinning of skin and things like that. That's when you'd be thinking about tacrolimus too.
Yeah, like we've said, really good practical. And we talked a bit already about bringing patients in, showing how to use the creams. I think eczema is a really good indicator for, as you say, shared decision making, but also practical skills for parents and for children and for adults. I signpost people to a website called Eczema Care Online. That's an evidence-based website developed by the National Institute for Health Research and colleagues at Southampton. They did a trial of it and it showed it did get better impact in a randomized trial.
I mean, the other thing that I do with parents and kids as well is just making it part of a routine and a daily life as well. We had a doctor who worked with us, you may know her, Tom, called Rosie Wellesley, who's a children's book illustrator and writer as well. And she wrote a book called Itchysaurus, the Dinosaur with Eczema. And again, it's a tool for parents to read to their kids and make it fun and things to really not make people feel self-conscious, because there's a really huge psychological impact on kids and adults of having eczema that you may or may not be able to see.
Rosie's book is really good. I think it won awards as well for best children's medical book. Then we may get to the stage about assessing for infection, or when we get worried and when we might need to refer in for extra help or support.
So we've got our eczema flare-up that we need to get under control. But as we're reviewing any case of eczema, the kind of things that you're really worried about is superlying infection. So often with Staphylococcus and with eczema herpeticum, so where you'll see vesicles and a viral infection on top as well. So when we are assessing patients, we're specifically looking for that. We should really specifically be documenting as well around the absence of that. And if we are finding it, then initially, for infection, we'd be thinking about topical steroids. And with eczema herpeticum, we're looking at sending patients into hospital initially.
And with infections, topical and oral antibiotics potentially, depending on the severity of the infection.
Exactly.
And then what about which ones we might need advice and guidance from secondary care?
As a rule of thumb, I think for most conditions, if there's diagnostic uncertainty, that's one of the key reasons to send people in for advice and guidance. Or if we're finding that the usual treatment options are not working in primary care and we're not able to get on top of it, then that's another reason. So for many patients, I would be going as far as sort of moderately potent steroids, trying the protopics, reinforcing at every stage, so all the basic stuff around triggers and bathing and emotions. And if we're still finding a struggle on getting the eczema under control, then that's when we would be looking to refer. But the vast majority of patients we can manage in primary care. Occasionally, we'll have very severe cases which may need bandaging or wet wraps, which is sometimes useful in children with very severe cases, and that can reduce itching and allow healing. So the help of eczema nurses through the dermatology clinics is sometimes really helpful for that as well. And then anyone who we think actually the topical treatments are not working and we may need to consider maybe more systemic treatments, then we'd be sending into dermatology for support as well.
So I absolutely agree. I mean, the vast majority, 90-95% or more, can be managed in primary care. And it might be if you're feeling that recurrent flare-ups, obviously with the digital tools, it's always useful, I think, to defer to a face-to-face appointment, ask them to bring all the creams in, have that practical. Sometimes you get the basics right, and that can help it with using the tools that we have in primary care, which are the majority of the tools, as you note. And then in children, if it's really affected, we have had some positive outcomes from getting the pediatric community nurses to help with some bandaging,
yes,
helping kids who are maybe missing school. And then I'm sure each practice will have a couple of patients, but quite rarely needing systemic treatment for their eczema, such as methotrexate or the immune modulatory agent.
Yes, exactly. Often you'll find that they will then get discharged back into primary care. And actually looking back at dermatology notes and letters is quite helpful for then following up patients who've previously been under dermatology care, because often there's really good stepwise information for future in those letters as well. And I often, you know, at the consultation, print out these and give them to parents and patients as well as a reminder for them. But often all the tools or the creams they need when they have flare-ups are all documented by our very helpful specialists.
As you say, a really good topic, very common for GPs. So my top tip is I actually start summarizing once I've seen a patient and sending them a sort of text message. And I think this is a really good practical one where if you've seen them, you send them some practical top tips about how to manage their eczema, but also links to websites. So I think that Eczema Care Online, that's a really good one as a top tip. It's got really good videos. It's co-produced with patients and the National Institute for Health Research. So I think that's really useful. It's an evidence-based toolkit for parents to understand about emollients and eczema control creams, steroids, protopics, etc. So that's my one top tip for today. And obviously then trying out the different creams and emollients, seeing which one works for you or your patients.
Agree with that top tip. I'm going to add my top tip to that, which is being really mindful of atypical presentations in different skin colours. I think we often under treat or under diagnose patients who are not the ones that we've gone through medical school and seen in textbooks. So be very mindful of that and then just get the basics right at every consultation. So use every opportunity. And then finally, particularly with the use of online consultations, if you've got multiple areas affected and the photos don't quite look the same in terms of of the rash in each of the areas, just bring the patients in because there could be coexisting different dermatological issues as well.
That's really important, I think. Yeah, if in doubt, do see the patient. Don't just rely on the digital consultation tools.
Yes, absolutely.
Signposting to some other resources. So we've got modules on the RCGP website, the Primary Care Dermatological Society as well. And Cathy, do you use any other websites?
So the National Eczema Society, as you said, and DermNet is one of my other go-tos as well.
And we understand, I think a trainee may have developed a textbook about different skin types, and we can certainly post some links. Really great to chat to you, Cathy, today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Many thanks for listening to RCGB podcast. My name was Dr. Thomas Round. Please do listen to our other podcasts. Of note, when we talk about topical protopic, we refer to topical calcineurin inhibitors rather than any particular brand.